Stan Hieronymus joins me this week to discuss cutting-edge hop research and his travels. This is Beersmith Podcast number 189.
This is the Beersmith Home Brewing Show, where brewing great beer is our passion. If you want to take your brewing to the next level, visit beersmith.com, where you can download a trial version of our Beersmith software, subscribe to the newsletter, and get dozens of free articles on home brewing. And now, your host and the author of Home Brewing with Beersmith, Brad Smith.
This is Beersmith Podcast number 189, and it's early March 2019. Stan Hieronymus joins me to discuss the latest in hops and his travels overseas. Thank you to this week's sponsors, Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Every issue of Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine is packed with articles for homebrewers and beer lovers. They're currently offering 20% off their all-access subscription pass, with access to videos, brewing courses, exclusive articles, and Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Go to beerandbrewing.com/beersmith to get your all-access pass today. Again, that's beerandbrewing.com/beersmith. And also the Riptide Pump from Blickman Engineering. Designed for home brewers, this pump features a Whisper Quiet Sealed housing, a removable tri-clamp stainless steel head that's easy to clean, and a built-in relief valve for easy priming. It also has the integral Blickman linear valve for precise flow control. Get the Riptide Pump today, another great innovation from BlickmanEngineering.com. Again, that's BlickmanEngineering.com. And finally, Beersmith 3 is available now for download, and also the mobile version is out. Beersmith 3 adds mead, wine, and cider recipe support to the Beersmith platform, along with new beer tools, including an integrated water profile and mash pH tools. Dozens of new features, including cloud folders, updated databases, support for fruit juice and honey, as well as new Whirlpool hop options. Download your free 21-day trial today from beersmith.com and give it a try. And now let's jump into this week's episode. Today on the show, I welcome back Stan Hieronymus. Stan is the author of For the Love of Hops and has also authored a number of other books, including Brewing Local, Brew Like a Monk, and Brewing with Wheat. Stan has also penned hundreds of periodicals and is a certified beer judge. Stan, it's always a pleasure to have you back on the show.
Well, thanks for inviting me. It's been a while.
Yeah. Well, what have you been up to lately? I understand you've been traveling a lot.
A fair amount. I think to the listeners here, probably the most interesting thing, which we'll talk about a little bit later, is going to Norway. And one of the ways they lured me there is after I was done doing a presentation is I got a chance to spend a day with Lars Garshol, visit some farmhouse breweries in the Foss region, and talk to him about the book he's writing that will be out next year from Brewers Publications.
And that was in Belgium, I guess, or?
Norway.
Norway. Oh, nice. That's fun. Well, I thought we'd start with discussing hops. We've had you on a number of times before talking about hops, but I understand you've been doing some new work in discussing what makes the hazy IPA hazy, you know, things like the New England IPAs.
Well, it's not really my work. It's the guys at Hopsteiner, particularly John Paul May.
Okay.
You know, what they did is he gave a presentation called The Secrets of New England IPA at the Master Brewers Association of the Americas. It was actually, it's a combined conference called the Beer Summit. So it's MBA and then American Society for Brewing Chemists, so lots of letters. And it was voted both the best presentation by the people who saw it, and then also by the technical committee. And in analyzing New England IPA, one really clever thing they did is they freeze dried the haze to see what was in the haze. You know, we spent a lot of time as this has come up, we're going, does this beer really need to be hazy to contain these nice flavors and character that people have fallen in love with? Or could you do a clear beer? Not necessarily the brut IPA, which is bone dry, but a beer that tastes the same, smells the same, and tastes the same, but doesn't look so hazy. What they found is the haze is important. What they also found is the haze is not a product of having a lot of yeast in suspension. Yeast does not register as hazy. There is You know, what's known, it's called NTU. It's a way to measure the haze, and most of these New England IPAs are around 600 NTU, and they're getting just a tiny bit of that from the yeast. Most cases, it is. Well, what they did is when they analyzed it, for instance, and I got to look at these numbers, they found 36% of it is from proteins, 3% from polyphenols, less than 1% from fatty acids, and 11% from hop acids. You'll notice that doesn't add up to 100%, but it gives you an idea of the makeup of it. So the important thing there, of course, is the protein and the polyphenols, which is what people are getting with the addition of, say, wheat and oats as part of the grist.
Interesting.
And so those are important. But you know, what they're also seeing is that the haze is acting as a carrier. So it increases the concentration of the nonpolar hop compounds. And those are compounds such as myrcene, the alpha acids, the beta acids, xanthohumol, which is something they measured. And in a few months, or in about a month at the Craft Brewers Conference, John Paul is going to give an updated version of this. And I think they're going to look at more of similar compounds, which are the oxygenated compounds. So backing up real quick, the quick primer on what you have in the essential oil in hops are about 65% hydrocarbons. So that'd be myrcene, et cetera. 35% the oxygenated compounds, and only about 1% the thiols or sulfur compounds. So what the haze is doing is that it's enriching these the flavors, the aroma and flavors you get from these other compounds, the nonpolar compounds. Thiols are polar compounds, so we don't know that it's changing the thiol makeup.
So we talked, I think, in the last episode about thiols pretty extensively. But let me step back for a minute, though. Is we have long theorized that the hops interacting with the yeast is creating some of the haze. But you're saying no. A lot of it's coming from the wheat and the. What actually causes it?
Okay. Well, the proteins remain. So you're getting the proteins and polyphenols from the different malted grains. You also get polyphenols from hops. So hops are a contributor, and the alpha acids themselves are a contributor. So they are part of the haze. They're just not the major part of the haze. It would be more like the polyphenols. So one thing, the question is, what is their contribution to the mouthfeel? Because, you know, these beers have a different sort of bitterness. And what people refer to as that juicy character. So how much of that is coming from the hops? Some. More of it is likely coming from whatever the grain bill is. Then to the difference of the bitterness, when you started learning to brew, and you would say, this is how we calculate the IBU in the hop, and you're doing, for instance, using your software, it's based upon how we know things act. And what's really important, obviously, is utilization.
Right.
So you're providing people a calculation that allows them to have come pretty dang close, if you don't dry hop the beer, to if you sent that beer off to be measured, the IBU. So it's not exactly the same as iso alpha acids, but that's the major contributor to bitterness. What changes in these heavily dry hop beers is you have a lot less iso. In some cases, people are not boiling at all. You're not getting the isomerized bitterness. You are getting bitterness, though, because of the humulinones, which I think we talked about before, and that is the oxidized hop compounds. So during the pelleting process, that's when this begins. And the oxidized alpha acids, known as humulinones, are soluble. So they will turn to bitterness when you dry hop. It takes about 5 days. And they will provide about 2/3 of the perceived bitterness as isoalpha acids. Then you've also got just raw alpha acids in there as well when you dry hop. And those will come across as about 10% of the isoalpha acid bitterness. So it's a combination. What they did at Hopsteiner is that they look at a typical, if there is such a thing, New England IPA and say, what are the IBU measured in a traditional way, which is, you know, another complicated process. But the key thing is they could get something that measured at, say, 120 IBU by that measurement. Instead, they go back and actually use a more expensive process. Virtually no breweries have the machinery to do this, and measure the ISO bitterness together, and then they measured the humulones, took 2/3 of that, measured the alpha acids, took 10% of that to get a different perceived bitterness. Basically the same goal as IBU when it was created about 50 years ago, and found that that measure was about half. So if you had an IPA that measured 90, it was really about 45. And that's the biggest change of the New England IPAs, is the perception of the bitterness.
So walk us through how the hops are used differently in a lot of these IPAs. For example, I know there's a lot of people doing active fermentation hopping.
Yeah, so that's a question. What people are trying to achieve with that is, for instance, we know that when you have a geranial and yeast are active, the measurement of geranial will go down and the amount of citronella will go up. This isn't a one-to-one conversion. You've got other compounds involved, some of them geranial. We were talking about geraniol, but there's also geranial and there's also geranial acetate. The nerol plays a factor. So you've got various compounds that get converted into one thing we can measure, is citronellyl, and that has more of a citrus character. Sometimes people refer to it as lime-like. And that's the conversion people want. And the feeling is there's more biotransformations going on. This is a chemical process. So that's taking place. So that's why brewers are sometimes adding it after 1 day, 2 days, sometimes after 1 day and 3 days to get these different conversions. They find things that work for them. Right now, it's hard to say why that works for them, because the other factor, which we talked about before, is the role of thiols. And thiols are not converted by the yeast. The thiols are there. But they interact with the other compounds to give you this impression. What people are excited about right now are that tropical fruit, guava, those sorts of aromas and flavors.
Which is also associated with some New England IPAs, right?
Oh, right, because of the hop varieties people are using. But, you know, so if brewers are looking, and not as important to home brewers, obviously important to commercial brewers, in order to do to create beer more efficiently, because our time has value to us, the fewer steps you can put in any process, then you are eliminating the chance for error. In this case, a beer, we would say, for instance, ending up with defective beer. So if you can simplify it and say, I don't really need to be dry hopping. So a few measures to think about. When commercial brewers, they talk about how many pounds per barrel they're using. So a pound per barrel equates to about 2.5 ounces of hops for a 5-gallon batch. And even simpler, well, not simpler, but doing the math, if you want to back off, is that's about 3.8 grams per liter. And, you know, since if you go outside the United States and talk to people, pounds per barrel means zip to them. So you want to talk about grams per liter, and it's easy to convert everything from there. So we got to time. It used to be that you were going to, you know, dry hop at, say, a half pound per barrel, if you dry hopped at all, which that amounts to like a little over an ounce in a 5-gallon batch. Well, now brewers are routinely dry hopping at 2 pounds per barrel, a lot of times up to 4 or 6 or 8. You'll see them say at times they're using 10 pounds per barrel, which is pretty expensive. So the question is, do you need to use this much? Is that adding to your mouthfeel? Is that adding to the flavor and the aroma? And science-wise, we don't really have an answer for that. The early research would, and it'll be nice when there's more, would indicate probably not.
And you mentioned longer dry hop times. You were talking about 5 days, for example, and I know a lot of recent research has pushed for shorter hop times. So where's the balance there?
Well, everybody's got to find their own balance. If you're dry hopping, let's say I'm going to dry hop at day two, then my beer is going to finish out after. First of all, depends upon the way you're dry hopping. But for the most part, those hops are going to be gone in 3 days. They're going to drop. Say you dry hop at the top, they're going to drop through within a few days. That's why people have taken to splitting that dry hop load and dry hopping. You'll see the term double dry hopped or triple or four even. And so you're doing it multiple times through. And the theory is you're putting less mass in there. You can have contact with the wort and with yeast. It goes through. 3 days later, you put more in. The downside to all of this and the massive hopping, so this is what changes, because this is what makes things really interesting to me, because 20 years ago or 25 years ago, we could say, well, we know all we need to know. But now people are dry hopping the bejesus out of stuff, and it has unintended consequences like hop creep.
Well, Stan, we talked back in episode 172 extensively about the thiol issue. How do the thiols play into this whole New England IPA thing?
Well, ultimately, what people are excited about is they add that fruity element, that tropical. That's pretty much clearly coming from the addition of thiols with the new aromas, flavors that are created during the fermentation process. Sapporo in Japan was at the forefront of this research, which began to introduce people to brewers. Always understood that there was some transformation going on with the hops and the interaction with yeast. So they started to make beer instead of using citra hop, which was pretty new at the time. They looked at the oil profile and said that looks a lot like coriander, and so instead of hopping a beer with citra, they hopped it with coriander, and they got some of the same characteristics you get with citra. So they began to look at other hop varieties that were rich in geraniol, and at the time they were thinking linalool is important. Linalool is important, but it's almost every hop variety. And you would take hops that are high in those two, and by golly, you were getting more of this fruity tropical character. Sometimes, though, you can look at the result and not understand what the cause was. You know the effect, what's the cause? So you can take a hop like Bravo, for instance, and Bravo has much the same linalool, geraniol, and citronellal quality at the beginning as citra. But you put it in a beer, a single hop beer, and particularly if you dry hop it a lot and have some contact with the yeast, you don't get that same flavor profile. So that's when they began to wonder where the difference might be. In this case, they took separately, not these aren't using hops, but using the same compounds. So taking a cocktail of linalool, geraniol, and citronellal. And you could see this profile. Their spider graph's only about 5 stars, and the bottom one, I don't know if you'll see this on the screen, but it's a little triangle going down. You know, tropical would be here with the Bravo. Then they added 4MMP, which is one of the styles we talked about, and boom, tropical now looks like this. Tug clear out. That's when you get the tropical. So it's the interaction of the thiols with the other compounds that you created during the fermentation process.
And we talked about thiols are only in certain hop varieties, right? Mainly U.S. and Pacific, right?
Yeah, it seems to be now. Were they just eliminated by the growing practices in Europe? Because there was, it actually begins with the wine people using a lot of copper for pest or disease control. And so a lot of hop yards on the continent are really rich in copper, and copper pretty much eliminates the role of thiols. Or is it the background of American hop varieties? And we definitely know it exists in American hop varieties. And then, of course, in New Zealand and Australia, they have no native hops. They have relied on, they use both European hops, but all those varieties that you're in love with, Nelson Sauvin, Galaxy, et cetera, have American heritage.
Yeah, they're derived from U.S. hop varieties, right?
Right.
Go ahead.
So there isn't much that we didn't talk before about the thiols. One bit of research out of Oregon State, which is really looking at more the when hops should be picked, and then also the character. So you could begin to say, if you wanted to look for one compound, and in this case, Cascade, and when Cascade is rated as the highest impact. In other words, people go, wow, that hop is making a difference. This particular research found that you'd be looking at geranial. But also looking at when the hop was picked, and when the later the hops are picked, the more, so thiols, of course, are in a bound form, which means they can be transformed, perhaps by yeast, not totally sure how that's working, and free form. And we've been looking mostly at free form because it's there. You're going to get more free form the later the hops are picked.
Interesting. Well, to wrap it up on New England IPAs, how would you make best use of hops in a New England IPA, knowing all the stuff you know now?
Well, one thing, of course, the difference is, as a home brewer, and you can say, I'm going to be through this in 2 weeks. I'll just have my friends over. You know, you want that haze to stay longer, then you probably want to. You don't want to overdo the adjuncts. Think about a wheat beer. It's a lot easier to make a cloudy wheat beer when you use 20% wheat than when you use 60% wheat. You get too many particles in there, gravity is not your friend. So it clears up faster. So the question is how fast you care if it clears up. So if you're entering competitions and you're shipping your beer off, and how fresh can you have it, and you want it to last longer, then I'd constantly be experimenting how to get the same things I did before, get it to a place you like it, and then start using less. Less oats, maybe, less wheat. That's in the grist. But also finding a way to use less hops. And one of the downsides of the hops, which I think we're going to talk about hop creep next.
Yeah, we are.
Okay, so one of the downsides of using all these hops is hop creep. Nobody worried about hop creep until the last 3 years. They were worried about it, but they didn't know what the heck was going on. It seems to be a new problem, and it's all a result of excessive dry hopping.
And what kind of a schedule would you use for the hops itself? Would you hop during the fermentation? Would you use a huge amount of dry hops? How would you best do it?
I'm interested in seeing what people can do without the hopping during the fermentation. So if you hop in the whirlpool, you're going to retain most of your oils. And that's why people are hopping during fermentation, because you want the maximum number of oils there. You don't want to boil off the oils.
So you probably go with a strong whirlpool hop then?
A whirlpool and not too warm. So you're not isomerizing the hops. Unless you want a little bit, you know, you want to start by throwing a few hops in right at the beginning of the boil, just to stabilize your boil. And you're going to get a little bit of bitterness from there. But otherwise, starting at a strong whirlpool hop, and then late dry hop. So basically, fermentation is almost over because you still have the yeast there. You're still going to get the biotransformation, and you're going to have a lot less moving parts. I like beers without a lot of moving parts.
And how long will you dry hop?
I like the double dry hop, dry hopping twice. So
twice for three days, something like that.
3 days, again for 3 days. And then you're going to have to, obviously, you want to make sure that you've got rid of all your diacetyl after that.
Nice. Well, let's talk about hop creep next. I didn't even know what the term was until very recently, but I think it's associated with dry hopping, right?
It's been 2 years ago at the Craft Brewers Conference. And so it's really Allagash. So you think Allagash, you don't think hops immediately when you think Allagash, but they've been at the forefront of supporting hop research, very involved with Hop Quality Group. And they started making a Hoppy Brett beer, which is bottle conditioned. So, you know, they've got a lot of yeast in contact with hops in a dry hop beer.
Mm-hmm.
And what they discovered is they started, and unfortunately, I don't have that note in front of me. I meant to look that up earlier. But their beer was very carbonated to the point they were worried about safety. So they went to Oregon State and they said, what's going on here? Why, we check and we've got no VDK when we bottle. And yet we are creating this second fermentation. And more than 100 years ago.
And VDK is a precursor, right?
VDK is, it's basically, I should know this, an embarrassing question for me not to tell you right off the top, but VDK and diacetyl, you can consider pretty much the same. It's a way to measure it, and it is a precursor, I guess.
Yeah, I think so.
So more than 100 years ago, in the UK, when people were dry hopping, some research indicated that there were enzymes in the hops that would lead to basically, if you had yeast present, you would get more fermentation. So what the enzymes are doing is they are, what they do, they're liberating the fermentable sugars, which would include both glucose and maltose. And they also contribute a little bit of sugar. So basically it's the same as the enzymatic activity you get during the mash. So they are, after you think your fermentation is done.
So this is in the bottle, right? So we're talking about a bottle conditioned beer that's at bottling, potentially, or at bottling. Okay.
So if you're bottle conditioning, now you're adding, but let's say you're not bottling it. Let's say you're just home brewing, in which case you've got some yeast present. All you're doing if you're adding sugar, for instance, before bottling in order to add some CO2, you're counting on some of that CO2 is already present and that there are yeast in there, and those yeast will interact with that sugar to give you the CO2, the carbonation that you want in the beer.
Of course.
Yeah. So that's what you're doing when you're bottling. That's what I'm
right.
familiar with. So, and you are not counting on getting more fermentation, creating more sugar. So now you've got more sugar and it interacts with the yeast. You get higher CO2 and the danger of exploding bottles. That was the first concern of Allagash.
And that's one problem, but I understand there's another one as well, right?
Yeah, so they give this presentation at CBC, and the brewer's in the room, and as soon as they're done and they start asking questions, they have two microphones, much like you would at HomebrewCon, and you get an immediate line on both sides from brewers. You know, among the people on the line is Vinny Ceruso from Russian River, and they're going, that explains it. we once in a while get a diacetyl problem. You know, if you're dry hopping with yeast present, you still, and you just leave that yeast in there, the yeast is going to be there. More sugar shows up, the yeast goes back, it does some more fermentation, so your gravity goes down, your remaining gravity goes down, because the yeast there, your alcohol is actually going to go up, which is why you can end up with exploding bottles. But if you take that and then you cool your beer down, the yeast has not had a chance to clean up the diacetyl like it would when you do a diacetyl rest. And that's why you can have a beer you think is finished, you think it's reached its target, and then later on you discover that you thought you finished at, say, 10-12, and you check your beer and maybe it's 10-10 or 10-8. And you create a diacetyl and haven't had a chance to clean up the diacetyl. So if you bottle condition, if you're a home brewer, you're shipping your beer off to a competition, you get a sheet back that says they tasted the diacetyl, and maybe you've got kegs at home or whatever, and you go back and you go, my beer does not have any diacetyl. Well, that beer you sent to competition may well have diacetyl in it.
Interesting. And you said it had carbonation as well because there's more fermentation going on, right?
Right.
I can think of several cases, particularly early on when I was bottling a lot, where I would get a lot more fermentation as the beer aged, you know. I don't know if it's related to this, but.
Right. So, and that would be because you hadn't reached the final. And what, you know, for IPAs, what particularly IPAs are first more alcoholic. So you've already got more residual extract remaining in the beer. In some cases, brewers are mashing at higher temperature to keep the RE up pretty high. So you've got that nice mouthfeel against, and this is a little more old school when you had an IPA that was really hoppy and bitter, and you don't want the impression of bitterness, then the higher RE, more there for the hops, the enzymes, to go to work on it. But then trying to figure out what's happening, what are your solutions for this? Obviously, for one thing, what brewers are doing, a longer diacetyl rest for a few more days, basically a second diacetyl rest, or at least an extended diacetyl rest that gets rid of some of it, but it can still continue. Obviously, the commercial brewer, you can actually go ahead and either centrifuge out your yeast or filter out your yeast. So if you don't have the yeast there, you don't get diacetyl. You will get continued conversion. So if you let that beer, a lot of people brew beer, even if you get rid of all the yeast, you want to let it sit a year, a big strong beer, and see what it tastes like. Well, a year from now, you're going to discover that it has continued to thin out. It'll have more stuff is converted to the sugar, so you're going to taste the sugars are going to be in there. And they will not been converted to alcohol because you got rid of the yeast.
Interesting. So this could happen in the keg as well, I guess.
Yep. And then the other part is what's discovering, and again, this comes down to what's changed in beer. Everybody's excited about retaining more oils because the oils are what are that the when we were talking about getting those part of that aroma flavor compound aspect before you add the thiols, you want more oils. Way to get more oils is to dry your hops at lower temperatures. There is some question, and this is a study that needs to be done and might be done, get done this season and harvest, is when you change kilning temperatures to lower them, used to be you kilned at 150, some cases people are kilning in the 130s, maybe you know, you were neutering those enzymes before, and now you're not. So when you boil your hops, boom, the enzymes are gone. So that's why they aren't a problem. Does that change? Is lowering kilning temperatures, is that a factor? When you pick your hops, is that a factor? There isn't much doubt that is the yeast strain a factor. For instance, who was I talking to? Daniel Sharp who used to be at Oregon State and did a lot of research when he was at Oregon State. We talked about biotransformations with him, but some of the conversations with him here before. He's now director of brewing at Ninkasi. So Ninkasi's house yeast, which the origin was dry London ale yeast, they don't have too much of a hopcrete problem with that. And he's talked to other brewers that are using California ale yeast 1056 that have a much larger problem. And this will certainly go to New England IPAs, when they use London Ale 3 at Ninkasi, which is one of the yeast varieties that people are using for New England IPAs, then that they have to let the diacetyl will take an extra 2-3 days to clean up. So diacetyl is more of a problem, but that could be, that's with the yeast itself, but it also may be the way the yeast is interacting with the hops.
So this is a problem primarily with highly hop beers, right?
Yeah, drop back your hopping, you've got less of a problem.
And what is the, what's the timeline? I mean, is it something that happens over weeks, days, months, years?
So when Oregon State did the study for this, they actually used Coors as a base, and they extended it out like 40 weeks, and it just continues. And it's, I would say it's fairly linear. So it's going to impact within a matter of days. In breweries that are measuring this carefully, they're realizing we're getting this spike in diacetyl, what will be close enough to immediately.
So it's pretty quick then. So, I mean, potentially you could do a diacetyl rest with it even in the bottle, right?
Well, you've got to have enough healthy yeast to clean up.
Right, right.
So it may not be. That's the key thing. And then, it appears to be variety dependent. Just to throw in another wild card. You don't know exactly because, this was research at Oregon State University. And what they did is they divided hops into four classes. One set, class one, had a high maltose production, so a lot of high fermentable sugars. And that was one that obviously those varieties were more likely to be a factor in hop creep. Then they had class four or class two, which are those that are really low in everything. And then two other classes, what they call class three and four. One is if they created a fair amount of maltose. The other, if they were higher in fructose and glucose, because those they produce less of. So what you have, so if you're looking and you're saying, I want stuff in class two, which are low diacetyl, then Centennial, Citra, Crystal, East Kent Golding, Eldorado, Galaxy, Herzbrucker, Sazer, Summit were all in that category. What was also in that category was Amarillo, Harvest Year 2016. Then we can look at the class one, which are the ones high, and Cluster was quite likely, Fuggle, Nugget, Perlay, and Amarillo class 2015.
Interesting.
So you've got Amarillo, one year, very high, another year, very low. Was that a matter of when it was picked? Was it a matter of the temperature it was kilned at? This is all research that has to be done. Research that there was no reason to do 10 years ago.
Wow. That's pretty interesting. And I assume there's not a whole lot you can do to prevent it, it looks like.
Well, you can hop less.
Yeah.
And that's why when you ask me, my goal, if I were constantly brewing New England IPAs, which I see no reason to do that. There's some nice ones around me. If I get a hankering for one, I can do that. But if I were trying to perfect it, then I would be trying to perfect it using less and less all the time, and the shorter dry hopping times.
Interesting. We're running a little short on time, so I wanted to get onto your trip with Lars Gershall. So if you could perhaps introduce that.
Okay. So Lars is, it'll be sometime next year. He's at work and pretty well done with the writing part because getting books out takes a while. A book on the farmhouse ales, we think in terms of, his first experience. He lives in Norway, actually outside of Oslo. He's an IT guy. But he has family from different parts of Norway. But his first excursions were Lithuanian. Of course, we know a fair amount about the Lithuanian farmhouse beers. But as he got more interested, he's been all over Eastern Europe, seeing all the different practices. So, for instance, you know, places where they are doing their mashing in the oven, places where they make what's known as raw ale, which means it isn't boiled. This festival that I went to speak to the brewers at, I had beer from a place called Eichentheim. They do not own a boiling kettle. They have a mash tun and a fermentation tank.
Interesting.
So, you know, he's written about all of these. I got a chance to go to the Foss Valley, which is just north of Bergen on the west side of Norway. And this is where he began collecting the Kveik yeast. And Kveik yeast is, I just saw there's a, I don't know if you're familiar with a Facebook group called Milk the Funk, which is.
No. I think you may have mentioned it in a previous podcast.
But. Yeah. And talking about the funky beers, and somebody commented the other day that this seems that the discussion there is like 80% about Kveik yeast right now. Everybody, you know, it's being imported by several yeast companies. I think Omega is doing some really interesting stuff and bringing those in. In the course of examining these yeast, they've discovered that we'll call this the true Kveik yeast is unique. And what appeals to people is this is a yeast that operates very nicely at 100 degrees Fahrenheit. In fact, sometimes it won't even get its job done unless you get higher than that.
Interesting.
And we're talking a pitch in it. And it, you know, so the version from Foss, for instance, is pretty fruity. From Hornendal, which is north of there, is even fruitier. So it has, they are very expressive yeast, and they're great for people who,
go ahead.
Sorry about that. That was my phone.
That's okay.
As a home brewer, doesn't have temperature control or even a small brewery now, and they can be done in like 2 or 3 days. So they're fast. And they do better at higher temperatures. So that's one reason people are excited about them.
And you said it's funky flavor as well. So how is it funky?
It's discussed, in Milk the Funk. In reality, it is not a particularly funky yeast, and this is something people need to understand. You can get, for one thing, what's fascinating about these are yeasts that go back hundreds of years. They're just passed down. It used to be in this valley that we visited, that there were scores of breweries. So people did not want to make funky sour beer. They make strong beer, usually around 8, 9, 10%. They boil for 6 hours, so you're taking reducing your wort in half. If you go to somebody, you go to a farm that's still making beer, you drink their beer. If somebody else from the region is there, if the other person from the region says you must live near a lake, that's an insult. That means your beer tastes like it's watered down. They want this beer to be strong, and they want it to be clean, and it has this expressive yeast and a lot of juniper character. So they're using, you know, you're using juniper throughout the process. So it picks up a lot of the juniper, which is not this type of juniper grows in Canada, not in much of the U.S. So if you wanted to replicate these beers, so people are excited to say this is a farmhouse beer, but it is POF negative. So POF is phenolic off flavor. And then POF positive is obviously does throw off phenolic off flavors. Most Saison yeast are POF positive. Yeast beer yeast are POF positive. Belgian Abbey yeast are POF positive. That's where you'll get the clove character and the spiciness.
Right.
These yeast are POF negative, which is just how this happened isn't clear, because there's very, you know, over time, wild yeast start off POF positive, and trying to get that yeast selected 200-400 years ago that was POF negative. This happened like two times in history. And then now we've got this other branch creating really interesting flavors. So you don't necessarily, you wouldn't want to use it in a beer that you would enter as a Saison, but you could use it in a New England IPA.
So it's a very, it's a unique style, right?
Yep. Well, that the yeast itself could be used in any beer style. You know, people are going to be excited. People are going to look at Lars's book and say, I want to make a raw ale. And that's fine. He's got a nice outline how you do that. And you want to make a Foss ale, you know, and particularly since it's not that you can get a few commercial examples, but if you want to have it in a historic way, it's got to be on a farm. There aren't that many farms making it anymore. And you can't really just show up at somebody's house. We did, but we didn't just show up. And see, the place we went, the building was from the mid 18th century. They also use it as a smokehouse. So there's a real sense of history there. And that's the nice, that's the exciting thing about this book, is just broadens our understanding that you could make what we refer to as clean beers, even though they're in the wild and there are other, microbes who want to get in there and add those flavors. When you make a beer strong in alcohol, you have good cleaning practices, you can make a nice clean beer.
Interesting. What are some of the other insights or techniques that he shared with you before we go?
As I said, it's basically the way people have been making beer for hundreds of years. So for instance, mashing in the oven, which is more of a Russian process, for
like
instance.
A bread type of thing, or
yeah, so you're creating you know, the mash, beginning your conversion that way. Certainly the raw ales, but just to see the Foss ale, using juniper, which is part of their environment, and then that super long boil, the idea that some neighbor's going to have the yeast that you need, because very few people are brewing all the time. Mm.
Well, again, what's the book? And when I think you said it's not coming out till 2020, right?
Right. And I would look for, I'm not quite sure that the title has not been settled.
Okay.
But it is going to be Norwegian, Eastern Europe, and Lars Garshol, which is Garshol. His blog is Larsga. And you can go read a lot of stuff that's in the book, but there's a lot of new stuff in the book. And it'll be the recipes and the process outlined for people who want to try and replicate this at home.
Nice. Well, I look forward to it. I want to get your closing thoughts before we go.
From my standpoint, it's just going to be another year of learning a lot of things. primarily,
you
about
claim
hops.
To be semi-retired. I'm not sure that's true.
I'm working on the concept, so I'm down to. I'm trying to work like you, maybe 40 hours a week.
Yeah, that's semi-retired, I guess.
But also, you know, I'm going to Colombia in May and Germany in June and Brazil in July. And in the case of Germany, it's mostly a family trip, but then I'll stay a few days later, chance to catch up on German hop research. The other two, I'm talking more to people about hops and other matters of brewing. And what's really exciting about that is to see how fast things are changing, you know, what people are learning. People listen to this podcast. So it's at an accelerated rate. And that's why we can suddenly be surprised by something like hop creep and then realize that now there are enough reasons to research and solve the problem.
Nice. Well, Stan, really appreciate you coming on the show again. And we're looking forward to your next trips. We'll hear about what you've done most recently.
Yeah, so we didn't talk about it. So I'll see you at HomebrewCon.
I will be at HomebrewCon. We'll have a Beersmith booth, of course, there, and yeah, it'll be fun.
that I haven't really figured out how I'm going to do my presentation, but it's called Seven Hops, and we're going to let the people who were in attendance pick the seven hops that we'll talk about. Actually, they'll pick six, and they don't pick right. I do get one to pick myself. And use those seven hops to tell the whole story of hops inside of 45 minutes. So there's a good chance that you'll get to see me fall flat on my face trying to figure out how to put it together, a PowerPoint that works with that.
Well, I look forward to that. That'll be fun. Yeah. Course, that's upcoming at HomebrewCon in Providence, Rhode Island. I think it's last the end of June, right? Yeah.
Right.
End of June. So all of us will be there. It'll be a lot of fun. Again, my guest today was Mr. Stan Hieronymus. Stan is the author of For the Love of Hops, as well as Brewing a Local and Brew Like a Monk. Thank you again for coming on the show, Stan.
Thanks for inviting me.
A big thank you to Stan Hieronymus for joining me this week. Thanks also to Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. They're currently offering 20% off their all-access subscription pass with access to videos, brewing courses, exclusive articles, and the amazing Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Go to beerandbrewing.com/beersmith and get your all-access pass today. Again, that's beerandbrewing.com/beersmith. And also Blickman Engineering, creators of the Riptide Pump. Designed for home brewers, this pump features a whisper quiet sealed housing, a removable tri-clamp stainless steel head that's easy to clean, and a built-in relief valve for easy priming. Get the Riptide Pump today. Another great innovation from blickmanengineering.com. And Beersmith 3 is available now for download on both desktop and mobile platforms. Beersmith 3 adds mead, wine, and cider support, new Whirlpool hop options, support for high-altitude brewing, and a whole lot more. Check out Beersmith 3 and get your free 21-day trial today from beersmith.com. Thank you for listening. I hope you have a great brewing week.